Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the New York State Attorney General issuing a notice of violation to the Donald J. Trump Foundation for soliciting charitable donations when the foundation is not registered to do so under state law. Tiziana Deering, a professor of social work at Boston College and the former head of Catholic Charities for the Archdiocese of Boston, joins us to discuss the extraordinary hubris Trump displays in self-dealing by soliciting charitable donations to his Trump Foundation, then either spending it on himself or making grandiose displays of phony charity by donating other people's money in his name. We'll also try to understand why average middle class and working Americans who pay their taxes could support someone who boasts he is smart for not paying taxes, which leaves the inescapable implication that Trump sees his supporters who pay taxes as being stupid. Then we'll examine the unsettling rejection of the peace deal between the Colombian government and the FARC guerrillas to end the 52-year-long civil war that has cost 260,000 lives. Michael Shifter, the Vice President for Policy and Director of the Andean Program at the Inter-American Dialogue, joins us to discuss this surprise upset vote of 50.2% to 49.8% of Colombians rejecting the initiative by President Santos while siding with former President Uribe, who campaigned against the deal. Due to the low voter turnout of 37%, we will assess whether Colombia is having a Brexit moment in which politicians misjudge the popular anger towards the widely hated FARC. Then finally, with today's announcement that the State Department is cutting off cooperation with Russia on Syria and Putin's cancellation of the joint U.S. and Russian program to dispose of nuclear weapons-grade plutonium, we will speak with Nicholas Harris, a Middle East expert at the Center for a New American Security. He joins us to discuss how the Russians have been stringing the Americans along in Syria while they change facts on the ground in favor of the Assad regime, and the likelihood of another exodus of refugees as the Assad, Russian, and Iranian coalition make further territorial gains while committing more barbaric atrocities and war crimes. And joining us now is Tiziana Deering, who's a professor of social work at Boston College and the former head of Catholic Charities for the Archdiocese of Boston, an anti-poverty activist and advocate for social justice. She has an article at CNN, Five Critical Questions for Our Next President. Welcome to Background Briefing, Tiziana Deering.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
And today, the Office of the New York Attorney General, Eric Schneiderman, issued a notice of violation to the Donald J. Trump Foundation, ordering it to immediately stop soliciting charitable donations in the state of New York, having found that the Trump Foundation is not registered to do so under state law. And this was, of course, prompted by some investigative writing by David Fahrenthold in the Washington Post. But the extraordinary thing about what we're learning about the Trump Foundation is that it's really more about making Donald Trump seem like a charitable person and boosting his charitable credentials than it is about actual charity itself, because he gets people to give him money and then he can turn around and give that money in his name. Is that the pattern that is detectable here?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, one of the things I think we have to understand about Mr. Trump is that everything is about the Trump brand. Everything is about building that brand, shaping that brand the way he wants to be perceived, and then maintaining that brand. He has not given his own money to the foundation since 2008, and yet as part of his response to the tax returns that were released by the New York Times over the weekend, he reiterated his extreme levels of charity as part of the way that he contributes if he's not contributing through federal taxes. But he hasn't contributed money since 2008.
So he gives away other people's money and takes credit for it.
Well, that's part of it. But part of what's been interesting in this series of investigative articles that the Washington Post has run is often it appears that what he's using is raising money from other people to put into that foundation, but then has made some expenditures that are clearly for personal gain. There's a legal term for that. It's called self-dealing, and it's patently illegal.
Well, this is particularly egregious, though, isn't it, when it comes to veterans. And Donald Trump, early in the campaign during the primaries, made a big deal about he didn't want to attend yet another one of the many Republican presidential debates, but would rather use the time to raise funds for veterans, which is about as mom and apple pie as an issue you can get in the United States. So he's made a big deal about it, but it looks like the Attorney General of New York is mostly concerned about fundraisers that took place that raised $5.6 million from wealthy donors and that are supposed to go to veterans. And there's apparently no evidence what happened to this money.
Yeah, no evidence of what happened to this money. A cynical use of a cause that's important in order for political and brand gain, from my perspective. And in addition, part of what the Attorney General is saying is that it actually wasn't legal for the Trump Foundation to raise that money because they weren't in compliance with New York state law around around fundraising. They hadn't registered appropriately.
Well, all 501c3 IRS tax-exempt vehicles have to register as corporations in the states in which they operate.
That is correct.
That's the law. So he hadn't.
And it's an important part of the sacred trust as well. When you become tax exempt, and I felt strongly about this when I ran Catholic Charities, that you make a trade with the American people. You say, we will not have to pay the same taxes that other American people will pay, because in exchange, we are going to provide a public good. And that is the only reason to achieve that tax exemption. It would be really hard to argue, given what the Washington Post has uncovered and what we now know about the Trump Foundation, that they have fulfilled their end of the bargain, which is to contribute to the public good in exchange for being exempt from taxes.
Well, the revelations, though, over the weekend that Donald Trump had a loss of 916 or posted a loss of $916 million in his taxes in 1996 and were able to write them off over a period of 18 years and not pay taxes as a result is extraordinary in itself, because what it indicates, and indeed this was verified by the very tax preparer who prepared the tax forms, which the New York Times used to verify whether this anonymously posted, these anonymously mailed returns were authentic. He made the point that this is a guy who doesn't pay taxes like the rest of us, but avoids paying taxes, but then takes that money and spends it on his own lavish lifestyle. So it seems like what we're learning today from the New York Attorney General is chapter two of this same tawdry tale.
Yeah, I think tawdry is a very good word for it. And, as you look across the landscape of so many of these revelations about Donald Trump over the years and the way he has skirted the corners of the law, the way he has used other people's resources for his brand and gain, at the end of the day, it appears that it is, always has been, and always will be, just about Donald Trump. And that's really concerning in somebody who wants to represent the American people, because that should be a position of servant leadership. And it is very hard to imagine him being capable of making that kind of crossover when so far it's all really just been about Donald Trump.
But surely the idea that you want to take credit for being a charitable person, and he has made this statement on any number of occasions about how generous he is, and it turns out that you're not generous. You're actually the opposite. You're incredibly selfish. And in fact, you're dishonest and devious because you're taking other people's money in the name of charity and spending it on your own lavish lifestyle. Am I missing something here?
No, I don't think you're missing anything. And I think there's an extra concern here, which is whenever a foundation or a nonprofit organization is caught in self-dealing or bad practices, it casts a shadow over many, many legitimate organizations who are trying to do good work. This kind of stink of corruption that we smell here will make people a little more reticent to give to some other cause that benefits veterans, even though that one is legitimate and doing great work and getting blood from a stone, right, in order to do this great work on behalf of veterans or other vulnerable populations. So the way this cynical practice casts a gray light on really good organizations, as one who's tried to raise that money and tried to help do that work, for me, that's an extra layer of awful on all of this.
Well, we spoke a while back when you had an article at CNN, the confusion that is driving support for Trump. Now, after the revelation of the taxes, where his surrogates, Governor Christie and Mayor Giuliani, actually went on the offensive and said, this just shows he's a genius for not paying taxes. And then he himself, in the debate, the first presidential debate with Hillary Clinton, when she pointed out that he probably hasn't paid any taxes for decades, he said, that makes me smart. How do you think that is playing with his own base, because these are by and large middle class and working Americans who do pay their taxes and aren't happy about their taxes. Nobody in America is happy about their taxes. In fact, most of us harbor the illusion that we're the heavily taxed when we're the least taxed of all the developed countries. But nevertheless, it's a prevailing feeling. Nobody likes the IRS. Nobody likes paying taxes. So the idea that you, the working stiff, is paying taxes, and this guy, who's the champion of the working stiff, doesn't pay taxes. Is that disconnect getting through, do you think, to his supporters?
You know, my guess is not to the most core base of his supporters, because we've seen so many disconnects over the last 6 to 12 months, and each time we've thought, well, clearly this will be the one, and it never is. That being said, for those who don't support, you know, there are some who support him because of the cult of the businessman, this idea that if you know how to run business, you know how to run everything. And it may, some of those may stay with him, you know, when Giuliani argues that he's a genius for failing, for not paying his taxes, he's arguing he delivered for his shareholders, he's doing what he's supposed to be doing, which is maximize profits. And for people for whom that's why they're voting for him, this clearly isn't going to sway them. But for people who are not as strong supporters, who he essentially just called stupid, people don't like to be called stupid, and they don't like to be treated as if they're stupid. And one has to believe that there's some percentage of his supporters who are going to hear that and say, wait a minute, what? And it will be very interesting to see over the next few days if polls can capture that, you know, how much of that is going on.
But why does anybody assume that his role will be, if he is elected president, to change the tax system that has benefited him and the wealthiest Americans so much for so long?
You know, I don't know why they assume that. And I also wonder, honestly, the thing I really wonder is, one thing he clearly hasn't demonstrated is an interest in or an acumen with complex policies. And there is almost nothing more complex in the American system than the tax code. So why do people assume that he's got the ability to reform it, period, let alone the desire to reform it when he's been able to find ways to make it work for him so clearly? But, you know, at the same time, the piece of this discussion that I feel like we're not hearing enough of is, why are people not expressing more concern over the fact that he lost nearly $1 billion in the first place? If we're following the cult of the businessman, you're supposed to be following the successful one. And somebody who can report losses of that magnitude, that should also be very concerning in a chief executive of the United States.
Well, the accountant who prepared these taxes from 1996, in which Trump wrote off $916 million, Jack Mitnick, who was approached by the New York Times, tracked down in Florida where he's semi-retired, he made the point that Trump's father was quite meticulous and serious about his taxes and was very engaged, whereas Trump Jr., he didn't really sort of, I think he could read between the lines that he didn't like Trump Jr., but he basically said, this guy is not serious like his father, he's sort of a dilettante and very sort of casual and airy about everything, and rather sloppy. You know, I'm sort of paraphrasing what was in yesterday's New York Times article. But, but it's no question that their tax accountant was making the distinction between the father and the son. And again, that refutes this notion that Giuliani and Christie and Trump himself are trying to put out there, that this guy is a genius who will fix the tax system for all of us, when in fact, you know, his own accountant says he's not really engaged.
Well, and this isn't the first time, I think, in the, you know, modern election era where we've had this kind of tension about intellectual laziness and whether being intellectually lazy about public policy, the law, key financial issues, makes you, quote, an everyday guy, end of quote, or just makes you intellectually lazy. And what I took from that New York Times story from yesterday, the one that you're referring to with the tax accountant down in Florida, was really an argument for the latter, that this is someone, it's not that he couldn't understand those tax codes, it's that he didn't care to. It's that he didn't care to understand the complexities of any of a number of things. And again, that's just so concerning. For someone who wants to hold the highest office in the land, people's lives are complicated, and we can't afford to ask to vote for someone to be a steward of those lives who is intellectually lazy. Smart or not, intellectually lazy.
But have we crossed that Rubicon? And to some extent, I think we did when John McCain chose Sarah Palin, that people now are voting for people that in many ways aren't qualified, and it doesn't matter that they're not qualified. They're so disgusted with the elites that they think that ordinary folk. Now, there's a massive difference between Sarah Palin and Donald Trump, even though she was elected governor of Alaska. I mean, he is the embodiment of the very oligarchy, if you will, that has betrayed the American people and run off with all of the riches from the last several decades while everybody else's wages have been flat. That's the, so it's sort of almost like double jeopardy that we're in here. Do you follow my train of thought?
I do. And I feel like you've tapped into something that's so important and central to what's happening. And back to this confusion thing that we talked about last time I had the privilege of talking with you, which is what people do know, people who are being squeezed, they are being squeezed. They're being squeezed badly. And in many brackets of the income spectrum in the United States, they've actually been experiencing some kind of squeeze since the 1970s. And so they are understandably desperate for change. And sometimes your change options aren't great ones, but there's a percentage of the people who want so badly for things not to be as they have been, especially economically and in some cases culturally, that they're willing to go with the change guy, even if all of these other liabilities are critically apparent. And it doesn't seem that we've reached that tipping point yet where the liabilities are so extreme that change that way is no longer attractive. And that's, it feels like that. There are still people out there who are undecided. They were going to vote for Bernie Sanders, and now they're thinking about Donald Trump. And from a public policy standpoint, that makes no sense at all. The only way that can be explained is from a change perspective.
Well, they're also thinking of voting for Gary Johnson. You've got, what's the name, Jill Stein, going off to Russia on Putin's dime, along with General Flynn, to celebrate RT's anniversary. I mean, nobody's even looking into these third-party alternatives that some of the Bernie people are supposedly entertaining. The whole thing is, to my mind, is nuts.
The other thing that's interesting about Gary Johnson is, once again, he's really embodied this intellectual laziness, not being able to answer basic foreign policy questions, not being able to follow through on, Chris Matthews, his most recent interview where he asked Johnson, name one foreign leader who you think is doing a good job or who you respect.
Right.
And to not have done your homework, again, it's the everyman patina over a layer of just being intellectually lazy.
Well, Tiziana Dearing, I thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thanks for the privilege. I appreciated talking with you.
And I do. And again, I've been speaking with Tiziana Dearing, who's a professor of social work at Boston College and the former head of Catholic Charities for the Archdiocese of Boston. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back examining the unsettling rejection of the peace deal between the Colombian government and the FARC guerrillas.
You need it, that's for sure.
Thank you.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Michael Shifter, who is the Vice President for Policy and Director of the Andean Program at the Inter-American Dialogue, and is a co-editor, along with Jorge Dominguez, of Constructing Democratic Governance in Latin America. He also writes and comments widely on U.S.-Latin American relations and hemispheric affairs, and has regularly testified before Congress about U.S. policy towards Latin America. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Shifter.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
And, Michael, what do you make of the sort of mixed signals from the Colombian referendum, given that there was a narrow victory to reject the peace deal with the FARC, but there was also a record low turnout? And that in itself is troubling. You'd think a country that has had 52 years of this agonizing, brutal civil war would have been more engaged in such a tectonic moment. But no, the turnout was, I think, about 37%, wasn't it?
That's correct. That's correct. It's the highest abstention rate in 22 years. And I think very disturbing, revealing a very wide gap between politics and the establishment and public opinion more broadly in Colombia. And I think, you know, there's people that talk to journalists and academics and government officials, and they're all talking about the peace process. And for many, many Colombians, that's just not something that touches their lives directly. And I think that's what we learned from Sunday's vote. And for those people who did vote, clearly they were not most of them, although it was very, very narrow, were not happy with the terms of the agreement. They hate the FARC. They don't trust the FARC. And the agreement was signed by a very unpopular president, President Santos. And so I think that to a large extent accounts for why it went down in defeat.
And, of course, the previous president, Uribe, led the no campaign, and 62% of the people in his home state rejected the deal. And now he's calling for revisions to the deal. My understanding right. that the FARC leadership in Cuba are sticking with the deal. So, you know, how do you proceed from this point of view?
Well, the FARC has said they're sticking with the deal, but they're also open to further dialogue and negotiations. Their options are not great. They're very limited. They're not going to return to the jungle and start fighting the government again and resume the armed conflict. They've been negotiating for over 4 years in Havana. Many of them already have gotten to the mindset of demobilizing and reintegrating the Colombian society. And so they're open, but it's going to be hard for them to give up some of the concessions that they achieved with the current agreement. But that's going to be very interesting to watch, that negotiation. And Álvaro Uribe is going to be a key figure at the negotiating table, along with the government and the FARC. And I think they're going to, you know, the best scenario is that there'll be a few modifications on a few issues. Both sides will give a little bit, Uribe and the FARC, and they'll come up with a new agreement and everybody can declare victory. But it's going to be very difficult to achieve. There's a lot of distrust among the different actors in Colombia.
Well, there have been, over 260,000 people killed, massive
Correct.
Amounts of kidnapping, extortion. The FARC have been in the drug dealing business. There's nothing much to like about them, is there?
No, they have virtually no political support at all, and they're seen as criminals by your average Colombian, which is why another reason why the vote went down as it did yesterday. And so, on the other hand, the Colombians don't want this war to go on, and they know that a military defeat is probably not gonna happen. They have FARC has 7,000, 8,000 combatants. They're in remote parts of the jungle, and So they think that some negotiation is necessary, but they think it should be on better terms than the current agreement, and that the FARC should go to jail for their terrible crimes. They should serve time in jail. They shouldn't be able to be prominent political players in the legal political system if they've committed crimes. And you may see those kind of modifications in the agreement, and I think that would be acceptable to most Colombians.
Well, what has kept them going for 52 years? Who's been supplying them?
Well, they've been, what kept them going initially, they've been around at the beginning of the 1960s, 64 when they started, and they were, of course, very much linked to the Communist Party. They were linked to, support from Cuba, from the Soviet Union. They were part of that access for a while, and then in the late early 80s, early 1990s, they got involved in the drug trade. They became much less ideological, and also involved in extortion and kidnapping and illegal mining and other illicit activities. And there are estimates of how much money they have, and they vary widely. And of course, the FARC themselves deny they have these enormous resources, but they've been funded by their own criminal activities, and that's kept them going. But they, over the last decade or so, they've been weakened militarily. They used to have 17,000, 18,000 combatants, and that's been cut by more than half. But I think there's a general agreement that they're not going to be defeated on the battlefield, that there has to be some negotiation. And the Colombians just didn't like this deal. They thought that they could have negotiated better, tougher terms against the FARC.
So what does it say about the Colombian president, Santos? I mean, it looks like the previous president, Uribe, is basically gaslighted him. I mean, he seems like he's almost a lame duck.
Well, he's still the elected president. He still has 2 years to go. He is still going to have to oversee and manage this process, but he can no longer do it, leaving out Uribe and his party and his followers. That's the message from this vote. So he has to incorporate them. But let's remember that this is a 300-page accord. A very, very high percentage of what's in there is agreed on. There are a few contentious, controversial points, and they're not going to go back from scratch. They're going to look at those areas that Uribe thinks should be tougher, and there's still, I think, a great value and contribution in terms of what's been agreed to on this very, very comprehensive, sophisticated agreement. But there were parts of it that really proved to be unacceptable to most Colombians, and so those will have to be worked on them, and to see to what extent the FARC is willing to give. They don't have a lot of recourse. They may threaten to go back to war and use that as a negotiating tactic and some leverage in conversations. But I don't think they haven't been in combat for over a year, and the FARC leaders have said that they're going to continue to demobilize and they're committed to peace. But exactly, we'll have to see what the details look like and how far they're prepared to go. So Santos, I think his support was already pretty low. This is not going to boost that, and his credibility has eroded. But he's not a lame duck. He could still, he's still the president of Colombia, and I think he still has a lot of most of the political parties who support him, and so he's going to have to go back and see if he can get another deal. I think that's the message, and it's going to be a challenge. He and Uribe do not get along well. There's a lot of bad blood between the two of them, and they're going to have to overcome, their mistrust and suspicions of one another, and their motives for the good of the country. And it's not going to be easy, but I think it's possible to achieve.
So in this deal, though, given that the bitterness that the population feel towards the FARC, was there any kind of reciprocity in terms of an amnesty that also included the right-wing death squads on the other side of the...
Well, the right-wing, the military, the paramilitary forces had a comparable, what was called the peace and justice deal in 2004, 2005. And it was criticized for being too lenient, although many of them served time in prison. Uribe, who negotiated all of that, used that as an example to show what he would like to do with the FARC. But of course, the FARC is a different, is a different kind of phenomena or a different kind of organization than paramilitary. They did start as a ideological political group in the 1960s. They were for a time a political party in the 1980s, and they were the subject of a lot of assassinations and killings. And you know, so there's a little bit of a different history there between the two. But I think that that's you know, part of what Uribe has in mind is what he negotiated for the paramilitaries, that there really be prison time. And there was what was called in this current agreement restrictions of liberty for those who confessed their crimes and committed egregious heinous crimes. But what restrictions of liberty means was not clearly spelled out, and that's what gave rise to some of the real suspicions and criticisms of the current deal, that there should be very explicitly said that there for certain kind of crimes that the FARC leaders should go to jail and be held to account. The Uribe thinks that it was much too generous and too lenient towards them, and he's going to go back and see whether he can get something that's a bit tougher. The FARC doesn't want that, but you know, their options, again, alternatives are not too clear, and it's not certain what else they would do. I don't think they haven't shown signs that they really, you know, want to go back to war after all of this this peace process has been underway for over 4 years.
But given the connections between the FARC and the Cubans, and that's where the negotiations took place, and that's where the FARC leader is at the moment in Havana, Cuba, there are also reports that the FARC have some kind of arrangements with the government of Venezuela, that it's itself is under siege from a lot of its own citizens. Mm-hmm. And there have been many reports of high-level officials in the Maduro administration being connected to the drug trade, including an arrest of, I believe, the relatives of the wife, I think Maduro's wife, in fact.
Maduro's wife, correct.
Yeah, yeah. So what are those ties? I know, for example, a friend of mine who was doing reporting for Al Jazeera, BBC, and The Guardian in Venezuela, she made a documentary on the border between Venezuela and Colombia, where the Venezuelans were selling gasoline across the border kinds of stuff. I mean, it seems like just total insanity that's going on that border. So what? Give us a picture of what covert ties there are in terms of the drug trade.
The ties are much stronger between, much less so with Cuba, even though the negotiations took place in Cuba, as you say. It largely took place in Cuba because that was I think the government felt they could be more discreet in Cuba than they could Colombia or Venezuela or elsewhere. But the ties are much more the reason why Venezuela has been very engaged in this process from the beginning is precisely because there were close ties between leaders of the FARC and Hugo Chavez when he was alive, and now Nicolas Maduro. And if there's any government that has leverage over the FARC or influence, it's the Venezuelans. And that, of course, as you say, there have been accusations and charges of top Venezuelan officials, including in the military, being heavily involved in the drug trade, as the FARC has been. So it's hard to know exactly all of the connections at all different levels. I don't think there's been a credible mapping exercise done of that. But clearly, you could say that the FARC has been, it's a major drug cartel, and there is a drug trafficking issue and problem within the Venezuelan government. But the Venezuelan government has played a helpful role for President Santos in leaning on the FARC and getting them to accept, that negotiation was the best course and leading to this agreement. And Santos has been very complimentary to the Venezuelans. So I think that, if the Venezuelans and other governments have any influence with the FARC, could say to them, this is the political reality. There was a vote, a rejection of the current agreement. Let's see if we can come up with something else and be flexible on a few of these issues. They don't have to go as far as Uribe wants them to go, but there could be a negotiation. I think they could continue to still play a helpful role. They are the government with the most influence on the FARC. So we'll see what, and of course, if the process breaks down, then it becomes the whole security problem in the region, the Colombia-Venezuela security problem becomes that much more, you know, acute. The Colombians are trying to stabilize their country. Venezuela is in a very deep crisis. It's collapsing and things are unraveling, and it has the highest crime rate in the world. Caracas is the murder capital of the world. Some of that is related to drugs, and some of it is related to other things. But Venezuela is a very, very serious situation, and Colombia looked like it was going to stabilize, and hopefully it still will. But this has clearly been a setback in terms of what the government was hoping to achieve.
Well, just in closing, just to try and get an understanding of this strange situation where a peace deal is negotiated between the government of Colombia and the rebels, FARC, that have been in a civil war for 52 years, has cost the lives of 260,000 people, and they do a referendum, and by a slim majority, the peace deal is rejected, although only 37% of the people vote, in spite of world leaders weighing in, including the Secretary General of the UN, Ban Ki-moon. So is this a part of this kind of new global phenomenon, distrust of elites that was exhibited in the Brexit vote, and God help us, could be exhibited in a vote for Donald Trump for president here in the United States?
I think it does fit within a wider pattern, both within Latin America as well as globally. There was a lot of suspicion and mistrust of the government, and Santos, even though you could argue that Uribe is also he's certainly from a wealthy family and certainly part of the elite in some ways, but he's seen as somewhat more connected to the people. He's got a very common touch. He's a very effective communicator and connects with people. Santos has a much harder time doing that, and comes from a very wealthy family that's been from Bogota, whereas Uribe comes from Medellin and in Antioquia. So I do think there's part of the explanation for what happened is this rejection of the political establishment and a sense that they were being lied to. They weren't being told straight what was happening. There was a lot of what was perceived to be secrecy in these talks. Things happened, but the government wasn't entirely forthcoming in terms of what steps were being taken. And I think part of what happened was that people rebelled against that, and Uribe interpreted that sentiment very, very effectively. He's a very skilled politician, and I think that's part of what we saw yesterday was a sort of rejection of the Bogota-based elite and newspapers. All of the newspapers are virtually in the country, all of the media, newspapers, television, were behind, supportive of the yes vote, and this was a reaction to that.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Michael Shifter.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Michael Shifter, who is the Vice President for Policy and Director of the Andean Program at the Inter-American Dialogue. We're going to take a brief station break and be back looking into today's announcement that the State Department is cutting off cooperation with Russia on Syria. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Nicholas Harris, who's a Middle East researcher at the Center for New American Security. He has extensive field experience in all regions of Syria, Lebanon, and Jordan, and his work on the Levant, Iraq, Iran, and Gulf countries is featured in many publications. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nicholas Harris.
Thank you for having me.
And the State Department today just announced that it's cutting off its bilateral channels with Russia over Syria. It does seem that the Russians, both Lavrov and Putin, have been stringing Secretary of State Kerry along for some time. And meanwhile, they are changing facts on the ground. And it seems pretty clear that the Russian strategy in helping the Assad regime is to target the moderate Syrian opposition, for the want of a better description, so that while Assad consolidates power, the moderate opposition is wiped out, and that leaves the U.S. and the West supporting what's left is the radicals, the al-Nusra and ISIS, which is untenable. And my sense at the end of the day, Nicholas, is that if indeed Russia, Iran, and Assad win, there'll be a massive exodus of Sunnis, and guess where they'll go? Europe.
So it's a very difficult situation. While it is correct to state that there is an increase in the influence of Sunni extremist groups, particularly Jabhat Fateh al-Sham, which is the al-Qaeda affiliate, within the broader Syrian armed opposition movement, particularly in northern Syria. It's not quite accurate to say that the U.S. would be left supporting al-Qaeda-sympathetic Syrians or ISIS-sympathetic Syrians. What is difficult is that the entire theory of the cessation of hostilities process that the U.S. has tried to engineer from day one has been struck with a fatal flaw. And that fatal flaw is that in order to get to a point where there can be a cessation of hostilities and where there can be space, particularly socio-political space, for the broader Syrian armed opposition movement to outperform, outcompete, and to defeat more extremist elements within the Syrian armed opposition, like al-Qaeda affiliates, the population in opposition-controlled areas of Syria, particularly northern Syria, need to be protected. And you correctly point out that the Assad regime and Russia have a very clear strategy, and that clear strategy is that they will target all opposition areas, opposition-controlled areas. They will besiege all opposition-controlled areas, and they will give the people of opposition-controlled areas a couple of choices. One choice is to stand down, put their weapons down, and either choose to leave their homes and go to areas further away that are under opposition control, or to put down their weapons and then become incorporated into pro-Assad militias, or to stand, fight, and die. And so this is a very clear strategy that the Assad regime and Russia are enacting throughout western Syria in areas that are problematic to the regime establishing a statelet in western Syria. And so Aleppo has become the real center of the attention for the Assad regime and its allies to try to preempt the formation of a capital in Aleppo, of an alternative governance structure, predominantly Sunni, of a free Syrian state that would be backed by Turkey and some other supporters of the armed opposition, such as Qatar. And so that is the stakes right now in Aleppo. The stakes from the regime's perspective is that if it succeeds in circling Aleppo city and forcing the surrender or the withdrawal of the armed opposition in the city, it preempts any opposition attempt to have a symbolic capital that can then be sort of the center of an alternative governance structure in the country. And so from the armed opposition perspective, the loss of its position in Aleppo City, while not fatal, would severely damage its ability to create an alternative governance structure in the country that could then be used in the negotiations towards a final political settlement that could lead to a transitional or a future Syrian government that has a confederal structure.
But do you accept that what I described is in fact the Russian and Syrian strategy? In other words, the Russians have been stringing Kerry along, and it looks like today he finally has given up, and the State Department has suspended its bilateral channels with Russia over Syria. That seems to be the case, is it not? That they've always known what they wanted, the Assads, the Iranians, and the Russians, and we've never been quite clear what we want. And now it does seem that the U.S. is left with few options. And in fact, while we're condemning the Russians for barbarism at the United Nations Security Council, and they are behaving in a barbaric way, they've also warned the United States not to do anything in retaliation. So it's almost as if, like, we're impotent.
The Russians have always had a much clearer understanding of what their objective was in Syria. And that objective was to, initially, at the time of the intervention over a year ago in September 2015, to buttress the Assad regime, to prevent it from collapsing. Once that was achieved, the next stage in its campaign is to empower the Assad regime to make significant gains in strategic areas of the country, like Aleppo, that will make any question about Assad's role in any type of future Syrian government moot. And the Russians have always had much more effective messaging. As you pointed out, Ian, you know, the Russian claim that it and Assad have not targeted civilians in opposition-controlled areas is false. That, you know, many international organizations have verified that, particularly over the last 2 weeks, attacks by Assad and Russia against civilians in Aleppo have led to the death of civilians, including children, that the Russians have at least tacitly supported Assad's strategy of starvation sieges in areas around Damascus, Aleppo, and the western city of Homs. They're very important to the formation of Assad's statelet. And that at the end of the day, the Russians realize that they have the most powerful message to send to the international community, which is, if you want to get rid of Assad, first you have to go through us. And to this point, the United States has not been willing to play chicken with the Russians. The United States, you know, does not want to have to get itself involved in a chain of escalation that could lead to direct conflict between U.S. and Russian forces over Syria. And, you know, that is a fundamental truth of the current administration's policy towards Syria, is that while the U.S. has been very generous in providing humanitarian assistance to Syrian refugees, providing assistance to Syrian communities, and has tried and has also provided military support for the Syrian armed opposition, both against Assad through reportedly the CIA and also against ISIS through the Department of Defense and also reportedly through the CIA, the U.S. has never made it a priority to have a forcible removal of Assad from power. And the Russians are willing to use force to keep Assad in power. And so we've reached a stage in the conflict where there's no question about whether or not Assad will be removed by force. The question is, will the U.S. and other members of the international community use force to protect the population of opposition-controlled areas? And the fatal flaw of the cessation of hostilities process was there was never an enforcement mechanism that could be used credibly against either the Assad regime or Russia if it broke the cessation of hostilities and targeted civilian populations. And the devil's dilemma now is that if the U.S. wants to enforce any cessation of hostilities, it will have to use force. And to use force, it could lead to an escalation chain that could have consequences way beyond Syria and include the region or potentially in other areas of the world, such as in Europe.
But given that the U.S. State Department has suspended its bilateral channels with Russia over Syria, and clearly Secretary of State Kerry has been incredibly frustrated, and also President Vladimir Putin suspended a treaty with Washington on disposing of weapons-grade plutonium. So that's happening at the kind of macro level, if you will, between the two superpowers. But it does seem that given that the major refugee flow out of Syria happened just after the Russian intervention, isn't it logical that if the Assads, with the backing of Russia and Iran, win, in quotes, this war, won't the Sunnis be driven out? I mean, I don't know what happened to all of those people that surrendered in the suburb of Damascus, Diriyah, but I would be, if I was a Syrian Sunni, I'd be very nervous about throwing myself at the mercy of the Assads.
Well, and you raise a very important point, Ian. This is another long-term dilemma. You know, the population of opposition-controlled areas that are targeted by the Assad regime in Russia really don't have many good options from their perspective. One option, as you pointed out, occurred in Daraya and in other areas in western Syria where, you know, they can lay down their arms, or they can agree to become incorporated into pro-Assad militias, or they can die, or they can go. And where they went, in the case of Daraya, many of those residents of Daraya ended up in Idlib, in opposition-controlled areas of Idlib. But the irony is that much of Idlib governorate in northwestern Syria is under the control of the al-Qaeda affiliate Jabhat Fateh al-Shem. And so, in a sense, it's driving members of opposition communities that are predominantly Sunni to areas of the country that are susceptible to al-Qaeda, to al-Qaeda domination. Another option is for the members of opposition communities to go become refugees, to go to Turkey or to try to get to Europe or other countries. You know, that increasingly is becoming difficult because Turkey wants to resettle the refugees in northern Syria. Part of the motivation of Turkey's Operation Euphrates Shield that it launched in August was to not only remove ISIS from its border, but also to begin to form out a zone whereby refugees could potentially be temporarily settled. Now, another aspect isn't touched upon widely in the mainstream media is that the U.S. has built out, through the Syrian Democratic Forces Coalition, which is a majority Kurdish militia, but also has Arabs, Turkmen, and other minorities, and is used as the primary vehicle by the United States in the counter-ISIS campaign in Syria. It has built out a U.S.-influenced territorial sphere of control in northeastern Syria, whereby you don't have the presence of ISIS, whereby you don't have airstrikes conducted by Assad or Russia, and where you have tens of thousands of refugees from areas that are internally displaced people, I should say, from areas that had been controlled by ISIS but are subjected to destruction and displacement because of the counter-ISIS campaign. People are flowing from ISIS-controlled areas to this new U.S.-built territorial sphere of influence in northeastern Syria. And that's going to also be a long-term dilemma because very soon you're going to have the major U.S. proxy in Syria being required to provide care and services for displaced Sunni Arab people that have until recently been living under ISIS. And so that's a looming humanitarian challenge. But to your point about looking at the long-term consequences, there are no good areas of Syria for Syrians. Even in the Assad-controlled areas of western Syria, in Assad statelet, where you have hundreds of thousands of internally displaced Syrians from opposition-controlled areas or formerly opposition-controlled areas, the local economy has been battered by high inflation, increasing lack of access to basic services such as food, electricity, potable water, the ability to go to the doctor. You know, these are very dangerous challenges that face even Assad statelet. And so when you look at the map of Syria, increasingly for Syrians throughout the country, the best option to meet their existential needs is to leave the country. And that is a problem that is not easily addressed by the diplomatic process that's currently being engaged in. And it's a problem that will need to be addressed by the international community and by Syrians very soon, or we could have a situation where you have a decades-long run of displacement for millions of Syrians who will be unable to either return to their homes in Syria or will be unable to leave the countries that they have fled to.
Well, we've already heard, I think it was the Supreme Allied Commander of Europe, refer to Vladimir Putin weaponizing the refugee flow into Europe with a view to destabilizing Western Europe. And you know that the refugee flow of a million plus people has created tremendous fissures. Hungary just had a very xenophobic and racist referendum on it, and their prime minister is making political hay out of the way that refugees are being conflated with terrorists and these calls of the dilution of European culture and Christian identity, etc., are going on. And Le Pen and all these right-wing parties and the Brexit vote is another aspect of this phenomenon. If there's another massive outflow, I'm not sure that Europe could take it. But you also brought up this very cynical Turkish position, which is, my understanding is the reason they want to settle Sunnis on the border between Turkey and Syria is to drive out the Kurds.
You know, it's Turkey's Operation Euphrates Shield, you know, as one of the objectives of Operation Euphrates Shield, as declared by President Erdogan, was in fact to prevent the consolidation of the Kurdish majority Syrian Democratic Forces all throughout the territory between Syria and Turkey, from northeastern Syria to Aleppo Governorate. So and throughout Syria's history, you have the settlement of people as a way of shaping the local demography to suit the interests of the power at the time. You see with the Iranians are importing Shia militias to be used in operations throughout western Syria, both in Aleppo, but also in the area of Damascus, and in case in Hama and Idlib, other western governorates. And you could see a scenario where Afghani refugee fighters that have been brought to Syria could be garrisoned along the boundaries of Assad's statelets and what are now currently opposition, Sunni majority opposition controlled regions, as a way to have a local border guard, if you will, within the territory of Syria to buttress Assad's statelet. But in terms of refugees as a weapon, you know, this is where the Russian strategy and the strategy that the Assad regime has fallen of using refugee weaponized and population flows is very insidious, because Russia and Assad and Iran, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps of Iran, win when the international community, but particularly Europe and Turkey, reach a saturation point when it comes to refugee flows, that they decide that they would rather that Assad wins, and that even if Assad turns Syria into another massive jail, they'd rather have Assad as the prison guard than have to deal with the inmates flooding out again. And that is one of the most insidious aspects of the Assad regime and Russia's strategy, is that you can reach a point where the Europeans have make a political decision that, no, the conflict needs to end. And if Assad is the victor, then so be it. And if Assad has to be the one that the international community looks to as having won the war, then so be it. And the history of civil wars teaches us that they last for a long time. The majority of, you know, all academic literature points to the fact that since the Second World War, the majority of civil wars end in a time period that's somewhere in the range of 10 to 20 years, a long time, at least twice the amount of time as the current Syrian civil war has lasted, and they end generally with a decisive military victory of one side over the other. And as we stand today in the Syrian civil war, it is more likely that over a time period of 10 to 20 years, the Assad regime's allies will win, quote-unquote, win the war, and will do so with a form of victory that places them in control of a majority, but not all, of the Syrian territory. And that will force the international community to make some tough decisions about how they orient themselves towards the regime, towards Russia, and towards what to do with the Syrian refugee population that many countries in Europe no longer want.
Well, Nicholas Harris, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
And we've been speaking with Nicholas Harris, who's a Middle East researcher at the Center for a New American Security. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me and scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Whoa.